Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 535. In this episode, Scott talks with Andy Kitchen about machine learning with TensorFlow.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today we're talking with Andy Kitchen about TensorFlow. How's it going?
Yeah, hey, Scott. Thanks for having me. This is I'm really excited to talk to you about this, actually.
Yeah, this is great. So we met at OSCON, the open source conference. And what were you speaking on there?
I was also speaking about machine learning, and the talk itself is made to be really accessible. So I try and explain machine learning, deep learning to everyone without a lot of mathematics and a lot of jargon. And of course, that's important if you want to do research, but if you want to find out more, get excited, get your hands dirty, I don't think that's necessarily what you need right away.
Machine learning is like the buzzword right now. Like, I can't open up The Verge or Ars Technica without something about machine learning. There's IBM's Watson, and everyone always says that Siri and Google, like, everyone is doing machine learning. Microsoft is taking over the world with machine learning. And I think that most of us who are listening, and myself included, we only know how to say machine learning, and that's about as far as it goes.
I think that luckily our intuition is actually strong when we talk about machine learning, and I think that's why we're happy to say the words. So ultimately, machine learning is the idea or the paradigm of getting a computer to become better at solving a problem as it gets more experience. And so It's a kind of artificial intelligence. It's a kind of AI, and most people think that to make AI really happen, to kind of make something that was smart like a person, a big part of that would be having it learn.
Is that, okay, so as soon as we said machine learning, I started thinking to myself, is that the same as artificial intelligence, or is it a step or a component on the way to artificial intelligence?
Machine learning is definitely a component of artificial intelligence. So I would say that almost all work on machine learning could be seen as working towards artificial intelligence. But there is artificial intelligence work which isn't focusing on the learning part. So it might be focusing on, for example, reasoning.
Okay, but we're afraid of artificial intelligence because Skynet will kill us all. Should we be afraid of machine learning, or is it like the safe part of artificial intelligence?
I think that in the future, artificial intelligence, machine learning will have a big impact on our society. I think all commentators do. There's a huge amount that people are saying, thinking about whether artificial intelligence will be good, will it be bad. I think that me personally, with these movements, for example, with OpenAI, the idea is to make these things open, make artificial intelligence open. And so I believe that more openness will mean that it'll be more safe. So I think that we should all get involved and have a go, because the more people there are in the world who understand it, I believe the less dangerous it could be, if there is any risk at all.
Okay, so that makes sense, because you wanted the title of this episode to be TensorFlow for everyone, you know, or for all.
Yes.
So this isn't one of those secret things that you need a PhD to do.
That's correct. And I think that's the really exciting part now. We're just moving into a time where if you can access the internet and you can do a bit of Python, there are great libraries, great tools, great tutorials that can get you going in an afternoon.
But now machine learning is related to or in the family of the much more threatening sounding name, computational statistics. Machine learning is easy to say. Computational statistics sounds like it requires a PhD. Why is it that machine learning is for everyone?
Well, I think just involving the word statistics makes people cringe and think of like pre-calculus. So, essentially, I think that there is a big difference between statistics and machine learning, which is a bit subtle, but I'll try and explain it as best I can, which is that statistics deals with noise. So you can kind of imagine or uncertainty. So you're trying to measure some particular number, but you get lots of readings of it, and they're all a little bit different in a particular way. With machine learning, one is much, much more interested in what I would call structure, in patterns. So to make that example concrete, if you were trying to look at a picture of a cat, it's not that there's so much snow in the picture or so much film grain that you can't see it's a cat. The reason why computers have a hard time telling the difference between a dog and a cat is that the complex patterns which make up their whiskers and ears are actually give this kind of texture to the pixels, which until now was hard to pick up using computer programs.
So the human brain is really good, if I understand correctly, at pattern matching and like looking at a picture and seeing a cat, or even looking at a shadow, or even if you had like a television tuned to analog static and part of the static was in a cat shape, we would be extremely good at picking that up, not in minutes, but in milliseconds, right?
That's absolutely correct. So if we're looking at, even a child can tell the difference between a cat and a dog, can look at something and recognize it, that it's a shoe or a face. And, the developments in deep learning have allowed computers to be much, much better at recognizing and processing information in that context where the noise isn't high, but the structure, the kind of the patterns that we're looking for are complicated. And that's where I think the real power of machine learning and deep learning are.
When is machine learning a good idea versus, I've heard some people say that maybe we shouldn't do that. We should do like Mechanical Turks, and we just need the power of a whole bunch of people to solve these problems. And then we chop the problems up into small human type operations. When do computers just completely blow them out of the water because they're just so much faster?
I think that overall, it will really depend on the situation. It's a hard question to answer, but I think that there are some interesting parts to that. So, part number one would be that we may want to go through amounts of data and content that even with Mechanical Turk, you just simply could not afford. So the amount of YouTube, if we wanted to have an algorithm look and categorize at every YouTube video, every photo that's ever taken on every smartphone, the volume is simply so high that having people do it isn't even a possibility.
There you go.
I would say one of the areas that I'm working on at the moment, which is incredibly exciting, is automatically diagnosing problems in X-ray images. So what we do is we take some X-ray images which have been looked at by doctors, and doctors have said, these ones have problems, these other ones don't. Then we'll feed them into our algorithm, and it will learn what the difference between an X-ray that's healthy and an X-ray that is unhealthy is. So then when it's shown a new X-ray that it's never seen before, it can make a new diagnosis without a person. And so in that sense, you can't hire people on Mechanical Turk who have medical degrees. So if those systems can become accurate enough, so for example, our system has the accuracy of just shy of a junior doctor, which is actually very encouraging. Doctors do get a lot better, luckily, with years of experience, but it is kind of in a way the first steps. And so I see that as a way to, for example, provide cheap medical care, kind of expert oncology, even to people in developing countries.
Interesting. So is this where this is the learning aspect of machine learning, right? The general idea is that you give it this corpus, this pile of data of which it has no context, and then you provide it with a bunch of context. And then it starts to say, oh, I'm starting to notice a pattern here. And then it can, for lack of a better word, guess what you would want it to think about that once you've given it enough source material and enough context on the source material.
That's absolutely correct. So just in the same way that you would teach a medical student, for example, what some kind of condition looked like, you would get your algorithm and essentially in code, you would say, look at this x-ray. Now tell me what you think. And it might say, oh, I think that's healthy. And then you would compare it to what the doctor said. And if it was right, you would give it a little bit of encouragement. You'd say, yes, you got that right. And you'd adjust the kind of in, let's just say we're training using this thing called a neural network. And I think we should talk a bit more about that. But we take the algorithm, we change it so it's more likely to detect those patterns, more likely to say healthy in that situation and agree with the doctor. Or if it disagreed with the doctor, then we'll say, no, you did it wrong. You should do it differently next time. And that concept is called supervised learning, where we have the input and we have the output. For example, a doctor's given it to us, and then we're going to slowly expose the computer to that data, and using the right algorithms, it will become better at solving that problem.
Okay, so machine learning is the family, and there are dozens and dozens of algorithms that you can apply to it that lean from supervised, unsupervised, semi-supervised. It's kind of like a slider bar of how much hand-holding do you want to give this machine in order to figure out how to think.
Absolutely. So in machine learning, there are three big problems with many, many different possible techniques. But the three big problems that people are interested in are unsupervised learning, supervised learning, and reinforcement learning. So unsupervised learning is, I don't know the question, but I know there's structure, there's patterns in my data. And so this is hard to get right. But when you do get it right, it's incredibly powerful because you might not even know the question you're asking, but you could, for example, feed in your customer data, and it might tell you something new you didn't know about your customers, that, for example, a certain demographic of customer was much more likely to buy a kind of product which you hadn't realized before.
This is when in the movies, when they're trying to find the bad guy, and they ask the computer to look for patterns going over the last 30 years across the city, and then the computer figures out where the bad guy is.
Absolutely, and you see lots of green text and flashing patterns, like flashing associations.
I'm sure that's exactly what it's like in your field.
Yeah, it is that entertaining, and it takes that little time. So then there is supervised learning. And in supervised learning, we know the right answer, but we want to get it. And you might say, well, if we know the right answer, we know how to get the right answer, why would we even bother? Well, the answer is because we want to do it more quickly or more cheaply, or because it hasn't happened yet. What I mean by that is if we want to predict what happens tomorrow, we can just wait till it's tomorrow and train our algorithm to make those predictions. So in supervised learning, we know the right answer, and we're going to show the computer the input and the output that we want, and we're going to then train it to produce those outputs, even for inputs it had never seen before. So to detect kind of what the relationship between the input and the output is.
So why isn't, this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's making me realize that there's so many problems that we could be solving with this. There are probably people listening right now who are solving problems at their work in a moderately inaccurate way with simple for loops and hash tables, and machine learning would revolutionize their business if only they knew about it.
I think that's absolutely true. So I think that sometimes I feel like machine learning has the chance to become very soon a new paradigm of programming. So people will talk about object-oriented programming, functional programming, and then machine learning, because it will be such an indispensable part of solving problems. I think that now we expect so much of our products. We expect them to learn our habits, to make great recommendations, to gently notify us but not inundate us. And all those situations where you want to interact, say, with a customer or a client, but provide them experience which is customized, which is relevant, you're going to need to use machine learning.
Interesting. So you feel that we're at the beginning of the hockey stick. This is going to be huge.
I definitely think that it will become very, very, very broadly applied, just like computers went from a niche thing, which a few businesses might have, to every single part of commerce now involves a computer in some way. I see that when we hit that hockey stick, simply every single product, application that people interact with will include machine learning in some way. And if you think about the amount of machine learning that goes on when you use to provide the news feed in Facebook, to provide your Google search, to provide your response suggestions in Gmail, you realize that there are very few products that you interact with today which don't have a machine learning component.
So why is it suddenly this? If it's got to be popular, why is it also now becoming accessible? And was it not accessible before some of these more recent tools have come out? I know that like Microsoft Azure has machine learning stuff. Google has machine learning libraries. We're going to talk about TensorFlow, which is an open source library for machine learning. Is it these open libraries that are now allowing the beginning of that, that up and to the right graph?
I absolutely think that like with all huge economic changes, the sort of broad-based economic changes, it's coming from a number of different sources. So I would say that the content, the educational material is free online of an extremely high quality. The tools, as you just mentioned, TensorFlow being the one we'll talk about, and also offerings from Microsoft and Amazon, just to name a few, these tools are really, really good, and they simply didn't exist sort of 10 years ago. So the educational material, the tools, and then the incentives. So there were points where companies just wouldn't have even collected the data to enable machine learning, but now all companies are amassing huge amounts of data because they record every interaction they have with their customer, and they're looking at ways to improve their business using that data to bring value. And there's only so much manual analysis that can happen. And the other part of the only alternative then is to get computers to do it for you.
Why would they give it away if it's such magic? If it's like if this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, why would they open source it?
I think that there's a number of reasons for it. I would say, obviously, with Google, there's always one part of it is self-interest. Another part of it is their general trying to make the world a better place. So the self-interested part is simply that machine learning right now doesn't run itself. You still need smart people to think about the problem, to apply the tools. So in a way, TensorFlow is a raw material. So the more people out there in the world who are great at TensorFlow, who improve TensorFlow, that is great for Google in terms of recruitment, in terms of mindshare. In terms of making the world a better place, I think that we're seeing now with the OpenAI project, a lot of money going into trying to make sure that the raw material of artificial intelligence, the source code, the know-how, is open source and freely available, so it can't be controlled by sort of a select few or nefarious means. So I think there is a part where Google sees this as a contribution to making the world better.
Okay, so let's talk about TensorFlow. It's open source, and you can get it at Tensor, TensorFlow.org. And it's pretty portable. It runs on GPUs. It even runs using graphics cards. It runs everywhere.
That's absolutely right. So TensorFlow is a very, very well-polished product. It came out of Google Research and the Google Brain team. And in fact, Google really put their big guns on it. Jeff Deans was working on it for a long time. So it really shows. It's really well thought through. It's very easy to install if you are on Linux or on a Mac. And if you're on Windows, then you can install it using instructions from Scott's blog, in fact. And
isn't that funny?
So it's
yeah, there isn't a way to put it on Windows, but it turns out if you have Bash on Windows, you can use it as well.
And so being well-packaged, easy to install, good APIs with good documentation, the fact was that there were tools before TensorFlow, and there was a great effort on the part of many, many, many dedicated individuals, PhD students, enthusiasts, to make them good, but they never really reached that same level of polish. So I think the one thing I think about TensorFlow as a machine learning tool, it's very polished and it's very easy to get started with because the documentation and tutorials are of a very high quality.
Yeah, there's a bunch of tutorials. I know that there's one at learningtensorflow.com that'll walk you through how to set this up. It took me 15, 20 minutes to get started. It was not... You know, of course, it's one of those things where it's like the game of Go, right? It's a minute to learn, a lifetime to master. But as far as setup, it's certainly not, it's certainly easier than SharePoint, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. So who is TensorFlow for? And I think it's for everyone. I think everyone can get started. Clearly, some of the smartest people in the world, the great thing is that some of the smartest people in the world at Google, at DeepMind, are using TensorFlow to do their research. And you can use the same thing. But when you use it, you'll be able to get started using tutorials, then go and try and solve harder problems yourself, find out the limitations of the information in the tutorials, learn more. But I really do feel like there's a gradient that right now, if you want to train a simple machine learning model to, for example, look at images, for example, tell the difference between cats and dogs, that is really something that is a weekend project, which before, literally 10 years ago, would have been a massive university research project, is now something you can do in your home, on your laptop, in a weekend.
Wow. Yeah, there's a great example by a guy named Ilya Poloksukhin, who's got a whole section on TensorFlow tutorials, where he changed my perspective on it, because I assumed that machine learning and learning TensorFlow meant huge data sets. And if I didn't have a huge data set, then what was the point? And in his example, he just goes through about 1,000 people who were on the Titanic, just a CSV file, and does all sorts of analysis on it. And that made me realize that, you know, I could have a small Excel sheet that had a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand records, and I may have insight into that, or the machine learning and algorithms may have insight into that that I would never have known if I had assumed that it was only a big data thing.
I think that's really exciting. And I think that a great way, if you're going to get started with TensorFlow, a great thing to do is as soon as you finish your tutorial, try and apply those same ideas to an interesting problem or data set that you have. And I think that that'll give you a really fun and interesting experience. One of the great things that is making a lot of this making this very quick and easy to do is this thing called transfer learning. And this is it's so amazing how fast things are moving in machine learning. So transfer learning was state of the art literally 3 years ago, and now you can download TensorFlow, clone it from GitHub, and there is code for doing transfer learning there. But what is it? Google has created really, really large neural networks, so they're brain simulations, and trained it on many millions of images, and then condensed all that experience into something you can download. So when you train that, for example, to tell the difference between cats and dogs, it doesn't need to relearn everything. It can just learn the little bit that's specific to your problem. It doesn't have to learn what is a picture, what is a foreground, what is a background. It's kind of been already taught that by Google. So now it can just learn the bits specific to your problem. It's called transfer learning because it's transferred experience that Google has given it into your problem.
And drawing parallels between things. I know that there's a website that's image-net.org. And they'll put up a bunch of random pictures and they'll say, what do these images find and, you know, have in common? And it's not something obvious that you can look at as a human. You might say, oh, well, they're all fish or whatever. And then you click on it and it'll give you like 14 or 15 things about exactly what these images have in common, from they're all invertebrates or they're all mutants or they're all you know, zooplankton or whatever. And it's just like, oh my goodness, you realize how we may be good at pattern matching, but the idea of drawing parallels and coming up with, you know, what's similar between large data sets is something where a computer excels.
Absolutely. And I think that some of the really exciting work that Jeffrey Hinton, who's now working at Google, was doing, was trying to train these models not on very fine, very coarse-grained things like restaurant, dog, cat, barn, but very, mm-hmm. very fine-grained things. So, for example, very specific kinds of plants, very specific breeds of dogs, very specific kinds mm-hmm. of mushrooms. And I think that's where it gets really exciting. And back to medical care is another example where we can condense the knowledge of experts. There might be only a few people in the world who can reliably identify the 10,000 different common mushrooms you would see around your house and say which one of them is edible or not. But you could condense all that expertise into an algorithm and then make it available to everyone in the world on their smartphone immediately. And I think that's really exciting, the condensing of expert knowledge.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It makes you realize that there's a class of question that we ask our computer now, like, you know, take me to the nearest Starbucks or is the library closed? But there's a class of questions that we can't really ask that we could, if what you're describing is possible. We could say, you know, there's a special kind of mushroom that we think might be extinct. Can you scan every publicly available photograph in the world that is geotagged and find anyone who may have accidentally taken a picture of this mushroom and tell us where it's located?
That's absolutely right. And that idea is incredibly exciting, that we could take expert knowledge and then stamp it out, kind of replicate it thousands and thousands of times, kind of, you know, into every smartphone or into huge banks of servers at Google. And I think that the exciting thing now, as we were talking about, is these reasonably what I call non-experiential problems. So in that sense, you look at a medical scan and you give a diagnosis, and then you look at the next scan and you don't really have, there's no dynamic environment. Things aren't moving or changing. You're just looking at one scan after the other, or the algorithm is. What DeepMind is working on right now, which is now a Google-owned company, and a lot of other very intelligent researchers, is this reinforcement learning problem. And the concept of that is there is a dynamic environment. The agent, we call it, which is the computer, can act and sense. So each time they act, the world will change and they'll sense something new, just like a person does when they open a door. They will then see what's on the other side of that door. And there is a reward. So, for example, I might get a reward when I go for a run and I feel fit and healthy, or I might get a reward when I write a piece of code that I'm really proud of. So what we want to do is give the computer rewards when it does something good. For example, getting me to where I needed to go on time or making me a recommendation which I liked. And we want to train it in this way to act and sense in a way that will maximize its reward. And if that reward is ultimately good for people, like making them happy or taking care of them, then in a wide sense, if these machines are sophisticated enough, they will learn to help us. And I think that's a really exciting idea.
Now, there is some talk about the idea of there's some ethics concerns around when we teach these things, how the world works, that sometimes the ugly parts of the world can come out. Have you heard about these issues?
Absolutely. And I think that there is an obvious possibility to use these systems in military applications, in very, I would say, unscrupulous profiteering applications. And ultimately, I think that there are many, many people who have talked about it in more detail and said it better. But ultimately, I think that we as a society have to decide how to use these things. And I think that's why it's very important that the power to use technology like this doesn't end up in the hands of the very few, the very greedy, or the very belligerent. It should end up in the hands of in some sense, the average citizen, the average programmer, the average high school student, so that they can make sure that we're accountable, that they understand these things, and that they continue to question how they're being used. And I think that's how we'll prevent them from being used in negative ways in society.
Yeah, there was a really interesting Google image search recently when people searched for three black teenagers under images. And what they ended up getting was mugshots, mostly of young black men. But if you searched for three white teenagers, you would get happy clip art people. And the question then is Google racist? Is society racist? Is this representative of factual issues, or is this representative of, you know, institutional racism that has been identified by the machine learning system and it's been discovered through looking at news articles? And how do we try to reflect reality without reflecting the nasty parts of reality?
It's funny you had mentioned that, and I think that when you were explaining that situation to me, which is just awful, something popped into my head. And I'm a technologist, and so I obviously think all the solutions in the world are through technology. But ultimately, I think this is an example of not enough machine learning. Google does use machine learning to decide what search results it should show you, and clearly, based on the statistical patterns and the limited amount of data it has, that's the response it's returned. But ultimately, you could imagine every time, or if you did see that on the Google webpage, you could then open up a text box and chat to Google, just like you would chat to Siri or Cortana or Google Now, and say, hey, you know, I really don't think that these research results are appropriate, and here's why, because, you know, it is prejudiced. And that would then feed back into the system, and it could learn from that as well. So ultimately, I think that I see a lot of exciting avenues to try and control the negative impacts of technology by making it more empathetic, more sophisticated, more able to understand and learn from our intentions and our needs.
And it's very interesting also that the search results have changed since the reporting of this story, and have actually reported kind of changed for the worse, because there are so many news reports about this, which now has increased the number of pictures and screenshots. So we find that the kind of the zeitgeist changes from month to month. Just as you've been able to fool Google into returning search results by having people link to it, machine learning algorithms can be prejudiced in multiple ways, depending on the, for lack of a better word, the ambient prejudice of the society around it.
Mm. So I would say that to try and tie these threads together, I think that I see huge potential in machine learning in medical care, because computers can learn how to provide us with more accurate diagnoses, in education, because we can use algorithms to choose the questions that we ask to optimize the level of learning, to optimize for engagement. We can provide better services by making them more personalized, more accurate. And ultimately, I see the interface, the user interface, fundamentally changing into the future as Cortana and Siri and Google Now become really the main way we interact with our computer. So I would say that it's really a great time to get started. It feels like we're on the ground floor of something, and there is a real energy to make it open and to make it accessible. So I think that we're in a surprising situation where something has gone sort of fast-tracked from being totally academic, totally esoteric, to download it and play with it in an afternoon. And that, I think, is incredibly exciting. And that's been enabled by TensorFlow. It's been enabled by Thano. It's been enabled by these amazing free books and tutorials out there. And that makes me incredibly excited. And I want you to go out and do some machine learning.
That's really important to remember, the idea that we can do this, as you said, in an afternoon or in a weekend. So I would encourage people who are listening to go and explore and learn about TensorFlow and other machine learning offerings that are open and available. And thanks so much, Andy Kitchen, for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.